spring savings are in full bloom right now at Lowe's, where you'll find great deals on everything you need to get your home in shape for the season. So hurry into your neighborhood store today to save big on all of your spring home improvement needs, like a $100 Lowe's gift card with a purchase of in-stock Husqvarna riding lawnmowers. Make your home happy all season long with great brands and great prices right now at Lowe's. Offer valid 3/9 through 3/21. Excludes garden tractors and zero-turn radius mowers. Excludes repaired and reconditioned items. Selection varies by location. U.S. only.
Welcome to Envision This, connecting you to visionaries of a more resilient, earth-friendly, equitable future. We are honored to have Derek Jensen, the philosopher poet of the environmental movement, as our guest tonight. He has inspired audiences across the nation, stirring them with revolutionary spirit. In an age marked by seemingly unstoppable environmental collapse, Jensen reveals new seeds of hope. Derek's new book, Strangely Like War, The Global Assault on Forests, provides us with powerful proof that we must address the corporate assault on life now before it is too late. Listeners, please make your contribution to tonight's episode by calling us at 646-652-2235 with questions and comments. You can help us give a heartfelt welcome to Derek Jensen, who envisions this. If we wish to stop the atrocities, we need merely to step aside from the isolation. There is a whole world waiting for us, ready to welcome us home. We welcome you, Derek.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I guess my first question is why you picked Strangely Like War as a title for a book on our global assault on forests?
I don't know how it is for other writers, but when I write a book, it usually has a working title that is merely what the book is about. Like a language other than words, my book that was originally I think it was the animal book, and Culture Make Believe was the hate book. Endgame was Bringing Down Civilization, and Strangely Like War was the forest book. And then as George Raffer and I were writing it, when we got partway through, we found this tremendous quote, which I don't recall the whole quote, but basically the person was saying that forestry is strangely like war, and you know, there are these machines that are going in. It's like a clear cut is like a battlefield. It's or like the site of a massacre. And we knew that's what the book had to be titled when we found that quote, because it's just so apt. That's what forestry really is deforestation, is massacring forests.
Yeah, and I'm going to back that up because, I mean, you know, here in Maine, my wife and I went up to Moosehead Lake, where you've had a corporation by the name of Plum Creek that did some clear cutting of trees up there. And, you know, we can talk about this stuff in words all we want, but until you actually see that devastation, it doesn't really hit home what we have become in our world.
Yeah, and it's really interesting you mentioned Plum Creek, too, because I lived in North Idaho and then Eastern Washington for, 12, 13 years, and Plum Creek was one of the big timber companies we were fighting there. And it's transnational. There's a great line by someone who wrote this, I don't know, 100 years ago, saying that, of course, the timber companies are basically sustainable. We cut from east to west, and we get to the west coast, we're going to go back to the east and start over. And they are, I mean, that doesn't make them sustainable, of course, but the point is that these companies are migratory. And, you know, I like I said, I used to teach in Eastern Washington, and there was a time that I taught at a university, Eastern Washington University, and there was a student I had one time who was a mill owner who'd been driven out of business by Weyerhaeuser. And, you know, our politics really disagreed on the timber industry in many ways. But we had some interesting conversations, and we eventually came to agree on some things. And one of them is that no one should be allowed to clear cut further than, let's say, 400 yards from their home. And if they're going to clear cut, they should only clear cut above their own water supply. And the point is that, you know, Plum Creek can deforest all over the country, and Weyerhaeuser can deforest all over the world, and the people who get the primary benefits from it never even have to see the clear cuts, much less lose their water supplies. But that's one of the problems, is that the timber companies are not tied to place. You know, it's like a lot of people have said over the years that, you know, of course, Indians would affect their land base too, and because Indians affected their land base, that means that, you know, basically transnational timber corporations should be allowed to do whatever they want. And Charles Mann is an example of somebody who does this. It just drives me nuts. But the big thing is that they don't recognize that the indigenous peoples lived on that land, and they were planning on living in that place for another 500 years at least. And so if your decision-making processes about land use incorporate the fact that you have to live here for another 500 years, of course you're not going to be stupid enough to deforest. You're not going to be stupid enough to destroy the land base. And if you're not planning on living there for 500 years, then you really have no right to be making those sorts of decisions. And that's, once again, one of the many problems with the big timber corporations.
We've been fighting Plum Creek. Not only, they stopped clear cutting. They've taken everything that they feel that it's worthwhile for them to get that hasn't been protected. But they want to sell their forest tracts for huge profits to developers now right around the lake. And it would totally change the nature of the place and, of course, bring more vehicles and more destruction into an absolutely gorgeous lake up there at Moosehead. And we haven't had much luck fighting them. When the public hearings are held, there are about 20 speakers opposed to them for every one for them, and yet the vote goes for Plum Creek.
Well, a couple things on this. One of them is that this is a script that is followed everywhere. Plum Creek did the exact same thing in Montana. This is what they do, is they deforest, and then they, I guess the word is extort, they deforest, and then they threaten to sell to developers if they don't get their way on everything else. And if they do get their way, then, of course, they'll just do whatever they want, and then they will sell to developers. And the same is true with the public hearings. I can't tell you how many public hearings I went to involving Plum Creek where it was the exact same ratio, and it didn't matter at all. And then, of course, also, I don't know how it is with the newspapers there. I'm guessing it's the same way, that there would be a ratio of 20 to 1 that night. So there might be 100 people speak out against Plum Creek and 5 speak out in favor. And then the next day, the newspaper, every time, would say, oh, there was a split opinion, and they would quote 3 people against Plum Creek and 3 people for, as though it had actually been 3 to 3 instead of 100 to 5.
Exactly.
And that's one of the things that is tremendously, for me at least, tremendously frustrating about this, is this script keeps getting followed everywhere. And it's one of the things, I mean, participating in these processes again and again is one of the things that helped to make me far more radical and militant, and to recognize that these public input processes are actually not about public input at all. They are, it's a show. It's really no different than the show trials in Soviet Russia. That basically they're going through the form of doing something, but that's not the real point. The real point is to make a show, and it has almost nothing to do with the actual outcome. We've seen this so many times. There was, oh gosh, what was it? There was something that had to do with Monsanto a couple years ago that the public comments were same deal. It was a ratio of 100 to 1, and it ended up not mattering. And the same thing has been true, of course, with a lot of timber sale appeal. I mean, timber sales are put out by the Forest Service. This is a process we see all the time. The whole system is rigged that way, which doesn't mean, by the way, that we shouldn't do everything we can. You know, of course, I'm not – when I say that the system is rigged, I don't mean that that means that we give up. What it means is we should recognize that it's rigged. One of the things that has been just so clear to me is that back in the 1990s, I read this great book called The Nazi Doctors by Robert J. Lifton. And one of the things he talked about in there was how before you can commit any atrocity, you have to convince yourself that what you're doing is not actually a bad thing, but instead good. And you try to sell this to other people too. And so, for example, the example he uses is that the Nazis were not actually committing genocide. They were instead purifying the Aryan race. They're doing a good thing from their own perspective. And the first time I articulated this, I read that book, and it really resonated with me very deeply. And the first time I actually used his argument was in an essay I was asked to write about deforestation, when I realized that that's one of the things we see all the time, is there are all sorts of claims to virtue that are put forward for why it's important to deforest. And those claims to virtue can be, we need to clear the area to build a town, or it could be that we need to thin the forest to prevent forest fires, or it could be that we need to cut down the forest because there's a beetle infestation and we need to cut them down so that they won't infect other trees. And there's all these different, or of course jobs, and there are all these claims to virtue that are put forward. And in fact, in the local paper, I live in Del Norte County in the far, far northwestern California, and it's extremely right-wing here. And there's an article in the paper yesterday about how the local supervisors are pushing a bill that's in Congress to attempt to open up more of the national forest for cutting, and it will be to support local spending. And there's always a reason, but the truth is it always ends up being deforestation. And we need to cut back. We need to understand that Plum Creek will have this or that rationale for it, but the bottom line always has to be what happens to the land.
Yeah, exactly, because we're so dependent on the land. But that's been obscured by the fact that we've lived in such plastic for so long.
Well, that's one of the things that the system has been very good at is at inserting itself between us and our source and the source of life. Mm-hmm. And a way to think about this is if your food comes from the grocery store and your water comes from the tap, you're going to defend to the death the system that brings those to you because your life depends on it. And if, on the other hand, your food comes from the land and your water comes from a river, you're going to defend those to the death because your life depends on it. And this is not in any way accidental. This has been it's not been a conspiracy. I'm not saying that at all, but it has been part of the logic of capitalism for a very long time. Because it's actually the logic of any abusive situation, that one of the things that an abuser has to do is to make the abuse victim dependent upon the abuser, because otherwise the abuse victim will leave. So this happens in abusive marriages all the time, where they're cut off from their system of support, they become financially dependent upon the abuser, and then the abuser's got them. And there was this great line by a pro-slavery philosopher in the 1830s, who was writing to his northern abolitionist buddy, talking about the land ownership conditions in which slavery is the best option for the capitalists, and land ownership conditions in which human slavery is not the best option for capitalists. And it's very simple. If you have a lot of land and not many people, then people have access to land, which means people have access to food, clothing, and shelter, which means they have access to self-sufficiency, which means that they won't go to work for you unless at the point of a gun, because there's no reason for them to work for you when they can have access to food, clothing, and shelter. But on the other hand, if you have a lot of people and not much land, or if you can convince everybody that Plum Creek owns all the land, which is just an agreement that we all have. I mean, they don't actually own any land. They have a piece of paper that says they own the land, but that's just a common agreement. But the point is, if you can convince everybody that Plum Creek owns all this land and keep them off of it, then what that means is people will become dependent on Plum Creek or Walmart or whatever for their food, clothing, and shelter, which means you can offer them whatever you want, and you control them. And what this means is that we end up in situations like you have in Appalachia with the coal mines, like you have in Wyoming with the coal mines, for that matter, or with the fracking or anywhere else, where you have people or where you have up there with loggers, where you have here with loggers, where you have people dependent for their rent, dependent for their livelihood upon a system that is actually destroying the land where they live. And that's an incredibly stupid way to organize a society.
In the case of all these gruesome facts that you're talking about now and that you present in your book, how do you remain able to plant seeds of hope, of resistance?
For me, hope is not the same as resistance. For me, I was doing a talk in Colorado maybe, 10 or 11 years ago, and I was just bashing hope. And some of the audience shouted out, "What's your definition of hope?" And I was like, "Oh my gosh, I don't know. You know, I've never defined it. Can you define hope?" And they defined hope for me, which I really liked their definition, the audience did, which is, hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. I'll say it again. Hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. And that's how we use it in everyday language. You know, when I get off the phone tonight from this interview, I'm not going to hope that I eat something. I'm just going to actually go to the refrigerator and I'm going to get something to eat, you know? And on the other hand, the next time I get in a plane, I hope it doesn't crash, because once I'm in the air, I have no agency. So what I'm really interested in is agency. And I'm interested in us trying to think clearly about this. I'm interested in us figuring out what we can do. And I'm also interested in, before that, figuring out where our loyalty lies. And that's a huge, huge question, because people will ask so often, you know, what do you want for the future? And I'm very clear. Okay, I'm going to back up a little bit. This is a problem. See, I didn't come to environmentalism, whatever that means, through, like, environmental theory. I came to it through being a frontline activist. And the activists I work with, you know, we were very clear on what we wanted, which is we wanted to stop this deforestation. We wanted to protect this stream. We wanted to protect the salmon. And that's really different than what I call the sort of environmental intelligentsia, where you get this other weird thing where instead of actually wanting to protect the ground, okay, there's this pretty interesting discussion that's been had among the environmental intelligentsia the last few years about people saying that environmentalism is dead. And one of the reasons they're saying that, this part I agree with, is they say so much of environmentalism has become not about actually protecting the land, but about continuing this way of life that's destroying the land. Like when people talk about sustainability, that's a totally different thing. Or when the UN came out with the whole sustainable development oxymoron, or when people talk about using wind energy, like those are all ways to continue this wretched party a little bit longer, as opposed to actually helping the salmon or helping the trees. And I think one of the first things that we have to do is to separate our loyalty from the system and put it to the land itself. I mean, now that I've given that little sort of lecture on hope, so far as where I get hope or where I get optimism, that's another thing, is I frankly don't have a lot of optimism. A friend of mine says things are going to get worse before they get worse. But here's the important thing for me, is that what I found for myself and what readers have said to me too is that a lot of the energy that there's this idea that if you acknowledge how bad things are, you have to go around being unhappy all the time. But that's not really true. And in fact, my experience is that it's not so much the pain or even the sorrow that hurts as it is my resistance to it. And so I just feel it. You know, I cry a lot. And I am bereft a lot. And at the same time, I'm really happy. And life is really, really great. And it's wonderful. And, you know, right now I'm sitting outside. And so far today I've not seen any bears. But I see bears every day during the summer and fall. And, you know, yesterday I know a family of bears that one of the babies is, he's such a little jerk. He's always yelling at his mother and his brother. And, you know, I see them every day, and that's a joy. And I see dragonflies every day, not nearly as many as I did 10 years ago. And so there's that sorrow that's always there too. But I just feel it. You know, I feel that sorrow and I pay attention to it. And I pay attention to the fact that I see fewer dragonflies than 10 years ago. And I see fewer newts than I did 10 years ago. And I do what I can. You know, I saw that there are, I was hearing, it used to be 10 years ago, 13 years ago, that in the spring you couldn't have a human conversation outside at night because the frogs were so loud. And I noticed that the frogs were getting quieter and quieter. And I live right next to a pond. And so I started exploring what was killing the frogs right here. And in this case, I've been able to do a little bit about it, because in this case, this particular case, they were dying of a mold called Saprolegnia. Well, the mold's everywhere. I don't blame the mold. The problem is the Saprolegnia's job in a pond is to eat the weakest egg sacs. And a decrease in the ozone layer has allowed more UVB to get through, and that has weakened a lot of egg sacs. And I read that on the internet 9 or 10 years ago when I first started seeing that this was a problem. And so what I've done here is every winter I get into the pond, and every winter and spring I get into the pond and I bring a whole bunch of egg sacs into the house. And I do that because UVB can't go through glass. So I bring them in, I hatch them out, and I put them back in the pond. And in this case, the pond is so tiny, you know, it's maybe 50 feet long, 60 feet long by 30 feet wide. It's so tiny that I think that that's making a difference. And so that's one little thing I can do. And I don't want to imply in any way that this is a sufficient response to the murder of the planet. But what I'm saying is that I saw that. Here's the deal, is the same thing is true with my writing, that one of the things I saw was a hole in discourse. I didn't see a lot of people. I saw a lot of people who were very concerned about the natural world, but I didn't see anybody talking about a militant resistance associated with environmentalism. And so instead of me complaining about this hole in discourse, or maybe in addition to me complaining about it, I decided to just fill that hole. And I have so much respect. I've learned this from other people. Like a friend of mine, John Osborne, who was really my environmental mentor and the guy who got me started on all this, you know, he saw that there was not really an effective environmental movement in Spokane, Washington. So instead of just complaining about it, what do you know? He just got up and did it. And I have so much respect for that. I think, you know, the big distinction is not between those who believe in militant resistance and those who don't. The big distinction is between those who do something and those who do nothing. I want to say one more thing. Can I say one more thing before we go on?
Absolutely.
Okay, this is the smartest decision I ever made in my life. This is when I was about 25. I realized I wasn't paying enough for gasoline. You know, the problems are so big and so just overwhelming. And I realized this, you know, this is in the 80s. And I realized this is just, what do I do? What can I do to stop this? And I was just paralyzed by how big everything is. But I realized I wasn't paying enough for gasoline. And what I meant by that is that what I paid for gas did not cover the social and ecological costs. So what can I do? And I wasn't doing anything at the time except complaining about how bad things are. So what I decided to do is for every dollar I spent on gas, I would either give a dollar to a local environmental organization, not a national one because I already knew they were kind of crap, but a local environmental organization. I would give a buck to them, but I didn't have any money. So what I decided to do instead is for every dollar I spent, I would pay myself $5 an hour to do activism. And so if I would buy a tank of gas, which at the time would cost me $10, that means I would do 2 hours of activism, which might be, it started off by writing letters to the editor. And at first I was so scared to actually express an opinion that I would use fake names. So, I've come from there to being able to write these books. You know, it's like I was so scared, but I did something. And then I started doing, you know, anti-fur demos or anti-circus demos. And I didn't let my ignorance stand in the way either. I remember going to the first anti-circus demo I went to. I didn't know. I just know circuses are bad because they treat animals bad, but I don't know any details. So I'm standing there with a sign that they provided for me, and some guy comes up and says, "So what's wrong with circuses?" And it's like, I don't know. Ask the person next to me, you know? So my point is, we can all come up with all sorts of excuses why not to do anything. There was my fear. There was my ignorance. There was the fact that things are so big. But those are just excuses, and so get up and start doing something. That's the thing. It really is true that those in power require the consent of the governed in order to do this. And You know, it's really important, even though it was 20-1 and they still decided against you, I think that that's a really important step. It is not sufficient, but it's a necessary step. I think it's part of what we have to do, but then we have to do, you know, everything else that works as well.
Well, actually, the collapse of the economic system has taken care of some of that. The rich people that they were expecting to build and buy condominiums up there got really blasted by what happened when the economy collapsed.
And
it's not really going forward. In a way, they're destroying themselves.
Oh, absolutely. Unfortunately, they're taking down everybody else with them. But you raise a really good point. One of the things that gives me the most optimism of anything I have is the collapse of the economy. This is by far the best thing for the planet. And it was true in the neighborhood where I live here. In 2007 or 8, we in our neighborhood fought these developers who wanted to come in and destroy part of the forest here. And we were really lucky because they were so sloppy and so arrogant that we were actually able to use the rules of the system to shut them down. But we knew that we weren't actually shutting them down. We were just delaying them. And then the first part of where we were lucky was that they were arrogant enough to just, had their paperwork not been sloppy, we wouldn't have been able to stop them. But it was sloppy, so we did stop them. And the second part of the luck was that then the next year the economy collapsed and they haven't been back. And it's just a delightful, delightful thing. And so many environmentalists I know, this is what we've been doing, is we've been holding on by our fingernails, you know, trying to protect this or that species we love or trying to protect this or that piece of ground until the economy does finally collapse. And my hope is that this is the long-term collapse of the system based on, you know, peak oil and everything else and just the murder of the planet. But this one won't have a recovery. And I'm even seeing signs of that, even in the mainstream news. I was just reading a mainstream economist a couple days ago who was saying that they don't think there will be an economic recovery in the United States for 30 years, which means, of course, with global warming, that there will never be one. So that's one of the things that gives me hope, is that places we can hold on, and maybe if we can hold on long enough, then that place won't get destroyed because of the economy collapse.
Mm-hmm. I used to listen to the news before I figured out that it was all pretty much bull anyway. But apart from that, it really started to shock me when I started to realize that I, inside myself, was cheering when the stock market went down, even though at the time I owned some stock. And it took a long time for me to understand that the collapse of the system was a necessary step to creating any kind of culture that would be humane and earth friendly.
Okay, I don't disagree with you at all. I completely agree. And I think, I mean, it's so important to have friends with whom we can, a friend whom we can call up and say, hey, the stock market went down 200 points today. That's fabulous, you know? It's great to have friends. I remember in my 20s, I lost this one friend because he couldn't understand why there's anything wrong with causing a species to go extinct. And it's really important. You know, it's really, I don't require, you know, I disagree with my friends on many issues, but there's a certain level at which, you know, I say this all the time, that I don't have any friends with whom I have to revisit Civilization is Bad 101 every time I open my mouth. But it's really important to have a supportive community that shares some fundamental values like that. So, and I'm also really glad to hear you say that you are at that same place. And I completely agree with you. We can't build, I mean, the system is so toxic and so based on exploitation and is so based on the hatred of the natural world and based on, you know, I'm going to write a book pretty soon. I don't know if it's going to be the next book I write, but it'll be one of the next two or three I write that's about human supremacism, because I think that's the biggest problem that is facing the planet today, is the belief that humans are fundamentally separate from and superior to everybody else.
Absolutely.
And, you know, that's one of the only intellectual supports for this whole system, is that, you know, it's okay for humans to Actually, I'm not even sure that it's yes, a lot of it's human supremacism, but it's even worse than that in some ways, because it's almost like there's a great line by this sociologist about 100 years ago. He said, and excuse the sexism, he said, in the past the man was first, in the future the system shall be first. And so there's a sense in which it's human supremacism, which we can talk about if you want, and there's another sense in which it's even worse, because it's like the valuing of machines over life. You know, it's like, who are the real winners in this whole system? And the real winners are the machines, because they're proliferating tremendously. And it's that whole system is just is also just crazy. And this takes us back to deforestation, because one of the things that always really, really made me mad was, but there was the, always the argument of jobs versus owls, that, oh, if you protect spotted owls, it's going to cost jobs. But the thing that nobody talked about is that the cut in the Northwest went up through the 1980s, but the number of jobs went down. And the reason the number of jobs went down is because of raw log exports and automation. And so even when they take it on a level of jobs, it's like, yeah, if you really want to have jobs, why don't you send people in with whipsaws, you know, and have them haul them out by horses, because that would actually save your jobs. And I was just reading this article the other day, once again on a mainstream news site, about all these jobs that have collapsed by about 50% within the past 10 years, simply not just because of globalization, which is bad enough, but also because of automation. The I don't remember most of them. I happen to remember, and I don't know anything about this industry, so this is the only thing I can say about it, is that the semiconductor fabrication industry jobs went down quite a lot because of increased automation in the last 10 years, like 50% or something. I'm making the numbers up. But basically, is who's actually benefiting from the system? Who's actually in charge? And it seems crazy to me to have, you know, a Japanese corporation benefiting from deforesting the United States, or a United States corporation benefiting from deforesting Chile, or, you know, I don't know, where is Plum Creek headquartered? Are they still headquartered in Montana?
I think so.
Yeah, I think it is.
Yeah, so you have a Montana corporation. That's just, it's, once again, I said this at the beginning, but it's bad enough when they deforest in Montana, but then it's completely nuts to allow someone who doesn't even live there. That's even crazier. That's once again the question of who's in charge.
I don't know whether it was you or one of our other guests that I've been recently reading, but somebody said the commitment of the corporation is to take everything that's alive and turn it into a product which is dead.
That's me, yeah.
Basic commitment of our whole economy and of the corporations is to death, is to putting everything in a box, just put everything that's alive in a coffin of one sort or another. And I just had to sit back and say, oh, my God. I hadn't seen it quite that starkly before.
Well, it really is the case. When you think about what GNP is, GNP is really a measure of how quickly you're converting living beings, like trees, into dollars, two-by-fours. Because a living being has no value. The trees, I'm looking at, I probably see, I don't know, 200 trees right now, or 100 trees or something. I see a lot of trees. And they have no economic value except how they might be converted into two-by-fours. I feel weird even saying this because, you know, the trees can hear me, and I would hate it if one of the trees was saying about me, yeah, look, he's got, you know, a dollar's worth of grease in him for, you know, $5 worth of fat and $3 worth of blood. You know, I wouldn't really want them to talk about me that way. And But it's true that that's what, and that's one of that's the central difference between Western and indigenous ways of being, is that so many indigenous people have said that their perception of the world is that the world consists of other beings to enter into relationship with, as opposed to resources to be exploited. And this is a huge, huge difference. One of my favorite lines from Strange Like War was some Canadian timberman said something to the effect of, when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And that's huge, because if when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way. And if when you look at trees, you see trees, you'll treat them another way. If I look at this particular tree, I see this particular tree, I'll treat it differently still. And I had an example of this just maybe it was about a year ago. I live on the coast, and every fall the crabbers work really, really hard for however long the season is, a couple weeks or something. And there was an article in the newspaper talking about why the crabbers are working so hard. And it's because at that point every crab was worth $1.50. And so they said, imagine if there were all these envelopes, each one filled with $1.50, on the ground. You'd run around picking them up as fast as you could. And, of course, that's true, but the real truth is that a crab is not an envelope filled with $1.50. A crab is another being whose life is just as precious to it as yours is to you. And so, once again, that's part of the central process of this whole economic system, is to convert the forests into trees, to convert rivers into hydroelectricity, which can be sold. You know, years ago, I was sharing the stage with Ward Churchill, and one of the things I asked him before we went on stage, I said, you know, isn't it weird that the Nazis kept such really meticulous records of the Holocaust? I mean, they would write down, like, how much gold they pulled from somebody's teeth, and they would write down how many people they killed. It's just crazy. You're committing this terrible atrocity, and you're writing all down these records. He just looked at me and he said, Derek, what do you think GNP is? I was like, oh, you're right.
You're right, exactly. And when it hits you, it hits you in the gut and knocks the wind out of you.
Well, I think that's really good, because I think that's one of the central things that we have to have happen to us, is I think that who we are and who we are taught to be growing up, I think that person, okay, I'm going to back up. I'm not a big fan of Christianity. I think Christianity has done tremendous harm to the planet for any number of reasons we can either get into or not. But I think the central metaphor of Christianity is really, really smart and really right on, which is death and rebirth. And I think that that's one of the things. You know, people talk about being born-again Christians, and that's really, that is a central metaphor for what has to happen in all of our lives. I mean, and I'm not even talking politically. Years ago, I interviewed Luis Rodriguez, who's a former gang member who got out through the Literature of Revolution. And I asked him, why do kids stand on street corners, gang kids, why do they stand on street corners, you know, shooting at mirror images of themselves? Or why don't they at least shoot the capitalists or something? And he said, there's a couple reasons. One is because the cops set them against each other. But there's another reason, too, which is they're teenagers, and teenagers are supposed to die. And what they don't understand, because nobody tells them, is this death is supposed to be spiritual and metaphorical. Because as a teenager, you're supposed to die as a child to become born as an adult. You're supposed to give up your childhood and become an adult. That's what you do. And in a healthy culture, you would have rituals. You would understand that that's the process. And they know in their bodies this needs to happen, but nobody's telling them how to make sense of this. And so they go out and they do really stupid things, and they kill mirror images of themselves. And the point here has to do with, one of the things I think, I mean, so many indigenous people have said to me that the first and most important thing we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds, to die, basically, as members of this culture, and then to be reborn as animals who, see, okay, I'm going to back up again. One of the big things that happened in the 1980s was that it was the first time the corporate press started calling us consumers more often than it called us citizens. And that's a huge transformation. Because if they can convince you that you're a consumer and not a citizen, then your range of resistance is limited to buy or not buy. A consumer can either buy or not buy. A citizen can buy, not buy, can petition, can vote, can not vote, can boycott, can organize. And when a government becomes destructive of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it. You can rebel. And what we need to do is we need to die as consumers. It doesn't mean we stop consuming. Of course, you know, I've got to eat something tonight. You know, we need to die as consumers and be reborn as citizens. And then we need to die as citizens and be reborn as something else, because thousands of years ago there was a transformation that was where we were converted to citizens of states from human inhabitants of communities who are human animals who need habitat, who need water to drink, clean water to drink, and clean air to breathe, and who have teeth and claws, and will resist when our family is threatened. And we need to, one of the things I think needs to happen is we need to have the wind knocked out of us. And there are writers who have done this to me. We need to have the wind knocked out of us, and we need to be knocked down And then we need to get up again, and we need to go, wow, I'm different than I was before.
Yeah. I'm going to ask
Which
you,
is one of the things you're doing with this radio program. That's central to everything you're doing, too.
Absolutely. Absolutely it is, and it's our purpose. I'm going to ask you at this point to read from page 6 of your book, because, first off, it will introduce our listeners to the book and your beautiful prose, but quite apart from that, you state so beautifully there how important it is for us to go out into nature and see and hear and feel and be moved by the devastation we're wreaking and to cry over it, and then come back to the book with. So would you please read that invitation from page 6?
Okay, I'm going to start with I walk. Where do you want me to end?
Start with.
Do you want me to read that whole section, 1, 2, 3, 4 paragraphs?
Yes.
Okay. I walk in an ancient forest. Redwoods who sprouted long before civilization reached this continent surround me. When a redwood falls, young trees often come up from burrows around the base or underground. So when you see several 2,000-year-old trees huddled around a space that one day might have been another massive trunk, it's easy to find yourself slipping even further back in time, perhaps another 2,000 years, to when the parent tree sprouted. Many parts of this forest floor never see the sun. Big-bodied, small-headed beetles scurry beneath ferns that run like a carpet between trees. Hard-shelled millipedes wriggle through the duff. At every step, my feet encounter rough surfaces of redwood roots that twine together tree to tree to hold these trunks upright through storm and wind. The roots, I've read, seek each other out to form nets of mutual support. Would that we remember to do the same. An old alder, downed in the last windstorm, cuts across the path. It died long before it fell, its branches growing bearded with moss. It served the forest when it grew, it served standing after death, and now it will serve the forest as it slowly falls apart. I make my way to a large stream. I stand in the soft soil of 1,000 years of fallen leaves and look out to see a salmon sweeping clean her nest. Her body is big and dark brown, her tail white and tattered from the journey upstream and from beating against the gravel beneath her. A sudden sound pulls my attention downstream, and I see another fish fighting her way up a series of rapids. She makes it halfway, then tires, or maybe realizes she's chosen the wrong path and floats back down. She rests a moment, then slides up again, sometimes shifting to her side, perhaps to keep as much of herself as possible underwater, perhaps to keep her belly from scraping too much on the bottom. She thrusts herself directly forward against the force of the water. This time heading directly for underwater paths, she can most easily follow to the pool waiting above a final row of rocks. She swims for the only break in that row, revealing an extraordinary ability to read and analyze currents, to precisely predict upstream barriers by what she sees and smells and feels in the water moving around her, and makes it to the pool. She cruises quickly to the dark at the bottom, and I do not see her again.
Why does that have such power? Why is it important that we experience nature at that living, visceral, detailed level before we can go out and work to preserve her, to help her, to become one with her again?
Well, I think that we can actually protect the earth without seeing everything. I've known activists who oppose clear cuts because they were wrong, because the clear cuts are wrong, and then thought, well, I guess I should go see some. And then we're appalled and we're moved even more. But there's the thing, is that at first it was intellectual for them. It's like, yeah, this just feels intellectual and feels. Those are wrong words to use together. But they knew it was wrong, and they were acting because they had worked their way through it. And then they went out and saw it, and they felt viscerally. And that's it for me, too, is that it's really hard. It's harder to love what you don't know. We need that physical contact in order to know. It's so they're not an abstraction. You know, that's one of the problems is that, you know, I mentioned the frogs earlier. I was talking to a person who lives not very far from me, just maybe a half a mile, so he's in the same forest, and I mentioned to him that the frogs were much quieter and asked if he'd noticed it. He said, really? I had no idea. But here's the thing, is I guarantee that if the San Francisco 49ers disappeared, this guy would know it in a day. And so part of it is what we, you know, you are what you eat. And if what you take into your body is America's Got Talent and the NFL, then on an entirely value-neutral sense, you're going to care about America's Got Talent and the NFL. And if what you take into your body is the sight of the salmon and the sound of the frogs, if that's what you pay attention to, then that's what you're going to care about. So I think that there's that level, and there's also the level, too, of it's really easy to talk about millions of board feet of timber or to talk about a tree having value only because it's turned into two-by-fours, but that's really different than looking at this particular tree. And I'm not going to say that looking at this particular tree is a panacea, because I've known loggers who have, you know, deforested all over the place, and they've spent more time in a forest than I have, you know, but they did it all cutting it down. And so it's, you know, a phrase I've used a couple times tonight is necessary but not sufficient. I think that it's necessary to see these things. It really helps, but that doesn't mean that you're not going to still destroy them. I mean, the Europeans who first arrived on this continent saw this wonderful, beautiful continent, and they immediately turned to destroying it. So it's not just enough to see it. That doesn't mean that you're going to love it. But I think that we forget. I mean, here's a part of it, too, is that we evolved as beings. We didn't evolve touching plastic more than flesh. That's crazy. We didn't evolve drinking Coca-Cola more than water. We didn't evolve drinking fish sticks rather than salmon. We evolved in relationship with all of these others, and they are part of how we become human, and they're part of how we become who we are. And when we don't have interactions with them, then we are at the very least cutting off much of who we are. And I want to be very careful about going too far down that road, because I get so tired of people talking, and you didn't do this at all, I'm not talking about you. I get so tired of people saying, oh, we need to go out into the forest to complete ourselves, because that's still really narcissistic. I mean, right now, the forests are being murdered, and yes, it's really great if we can go out in the forest and we can feel better because of it, but the real point is they're being murdered, and that murder needs to stop.
Which actually kind of boils into my next question, which actually was brought up to me by a friend of mine named Torch, who basically is saying that it's easy to get carried away with inspiring messages and philosophies, but without people putting themselves on the line against systemic destruction, it'll be more of the same. Could you share with him and with us and other listeners what you are involved in doing besides writing and speaking to save Earth's precious and life-preserving endangered forests?
You know, a couple things. One of them is that we all have different roles to play. And people have sometimes asked me, like, gosh, why aren't you an organizer? You know, why don't you stop writing and be an organizer? And the truth is I'm either tremendously or terribly introverted, whichever word you want to use. And I can do public speaking, but I've known organizers who love, like, oh my God, I've got this friend who loves having meetings, and she's a great organizer, and she gets so excited because she'll have like three different meetings with three different organizations set for one day, and that would just give me the heebie-jeebies, you know. And so we have to find what are our gifts, and then we need to use them. I've got a friend I like to mention who used to run the Battered Women's Program for the state of New York, and she's absolutely wonderful, and she's absolutely relentless, and she asks every man she sees, what will it take for men to stop beating on women? And, you know, she doesn't work on salmon issues. That's one of the great things about everything being so messed up, is no matter where you look, there's great work to be done. So part of my job, my main role in the resistance is articulating these things, is articulating GNP is the conversion of the living to the dead, so that other people can then go, wow, that punched me in the gut, and then they can do their work, and they can just pass that on. And that's part of it. But then in addition, there's, you know, I used to do, when I was in Eastern Washington especially, I used to do a lot of like timber sale appeals. And as I've been writing more and more, I've done that less and less. But I do want to mention one organization that I'm associated with, which is, it's called Deep Green Resistance. And it's an above-ground movement that is growing pretty quickly, and it is a movement that does above-ground actions, like trying to help stop the sale of alcohol outside of the Pine Ridge Reservation at White Clay, Nebraska, and has done some tar sands blockades, stuff like that. And in addition, at the same time, it is advocating for a militant underground movement to bring down civilization. And we are above ground because you need to have a firewall between above ground and below ground organizations. So we don't do underground at all, but we are the only group I know of who is openly advocating for the creation of an underground movement to bring down civilization before it kills the planet. So that's one thing I did want to mention. But the main way I serve is by doing the writing.
You also convene a conference, Earth at Risk, Building a Resistance Movement to Save the Planet, and it calls together thinkers and activists that are helping. How does this fit into your profile, your passion?
Well, we had two of them, and then unfortunately the message was too scary for the funders, and so we only did two of them. But it was the same thing. It was an attempt to bring together people who are understanding that the system itself is killing life on the planet, and that we need to remember earlier when I talked about how some environmentalism has really become switched from protecting the natural world to trying to make it so this culture can continue. And we wanted to change the focus of the discussion away from that, away from attempting to maintain the system at the expense of the planet for just a little bit longer, and instead move it toward, so the primary allegiance is toward the primary victims of this culture, who is the planet itself, and also traditional indigenous human beings.
Well, and we ourselves, but...
Well, yeah, we are too, and I'm not saying that we're not all victimized by this. I'm just saying that right, I mean, the oceans, if you had weighed all the fish in the oceans in 1870 and you weighed them now, there would be about 10% as many fish as there were then. I mean, 10% of the weight. And the oceans, there are solid scientists who are saying that the oceans could be devoid of fish within 50 years. And so there's a primary emergency. I want to be really clear that I have so much respect for my friend Charlotte Watson, who, like I said, used to run the Battered Women's Program from the state of New York. And I have so much respect for people who are working on issues that are strictly human. My primary, and people ask me what I want to see in the future, and I'm very clear that what I want to see is a world that has more migratory songbirds every year than the year before, and a world that has more wild salmon every year than the year before, and, you know, more rough-skinned newts every year than the year before. And so my primary goal is how do we figure out how do we get that to happen? And I mean, it's very clear to me, you know, when people say, how can we make sure that salmon survive? Generally what they're saying is, how can we make sure that salmon survive without taking out dams or stopping industrial logging or stopping industrial fishing or stopping global warming? And the answer is you can't.
In part, they're also saying, how can you guarantee that we'll have salmon to eat, which is a very self-centered.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I love eating salmon. I think I can understand why the Indians ate salmon here every day for 12,000 years. But my primary care is that the salmon exist for themselves and for the whole forest, because that's something that this goes back to the human supremacism and the belief that the whole world is created for us. And of course, we're not the point. I love this line by Paul Stamets. Nature loves a community. I just love that. That what's important is the continuation of this forest community, by which I mean the redwoods, the rough-skinned newts, the Pacific giant salamanders, the pileated woodpeckers, the spotted owls. And that's the most important thing. And salmon, I don't remember if I mentioned them or not. And that's what's crucial to me, and I think what needs to be crucial to all of us is the continuation of the natural communities who are the basis of life on this planet. That's one of the things that just kills me, is that, you know, when people talk about, say, like, when you hear mainstream solutions to global warming, this is the thing that just absolutely floors me, is when people talk about mainstream solutions to global warming, what they all have in common is they take industrial capitalism as a given and the natural world as that which must conform to industrial capitalism. And that's completely insane in terms of being out of touch with physical reality, because physical reality has to be primary, because without a living planet, you have no social systems whatsoever, which means by definition, the planet is more important than any social system. It's just crazy.
Well, it is, and I guess one of the things I hear you saying is that, you know, instead of being kings of the planet, and, you know, we are cells in the being of the planet, and, you know, if we destroy enough of the ecosystems, then pretty much we're dead.
Except take off the words pretty much.
But it's not even the most important thing that we're dead. How do you communicate to people that don't already get it that the forests and the rest of the nature here on Earth are sacred above and beyond the resources, the life support, the medicine that they provide to human beings?
Two things. One is, I love this thing I read a long time ago, which said it takes 10 years to change your mind. And what I mean by that, or the way that influenced me, is that I just make my point, and if somebody disagrees, I move on and talk to somebody else, because somebody else will be ready to hear it. Because I don't have the time and I don't have the patience to deal with fence sitters or deal with people who are actually oppositional. I remember, and this actually brings us back to forests, I remember being at a public input meeting for the Forest Service back in, 1989 or 1990, and I got into a big argument for like 2 or 3 hours with this guy that I happen to remember was the owner of a drive-in movie theater about clear-cutting. So we're arguing just fiercely for 3 hours. The guy's not even a Forest Service employee. I get home, and I realize he's not a decision maker anyway, so who cares? You know, I didn't convince him. He didn't convince me. We both just wasted 3 hours because neither one of us has any say in the Forest Service anyway. So I don't there are people I know who are really good at reaching people who are fence sitters or reaching people who are not quite there. I'm not one of them. I don't do that very well. But the other part is I do know that if I talk to like a local business owner, I don't talk about salmon because they don't care. What I talk about is the way Walmart is destroying their business because they understand that. So there's one thing I can do. Okay, I was doing a talk one time. When I do talks at universities, I don't like it very much when a teacher will force all the students in a class to come because then the students don't want to be there. They're not interested. I remember doing a talk one time where basically most of the audience consisted of students who didn't really want to be there. I'm doing my talk about the natural world. And they don't care. They're all texting. They're all just blowing off. And finally, I bail out on my talk, and I go instead to talk about how the wage economy forces people to get jobs, and most people spend their lives doing things they don't want to do, and how nuts that is that we all, you know, that we look toward the day that we retire. So how much sense does it make to be 20 years old and looking forward to when you retire and you can do what you want, and you're going to spend the next 40 years doing a job you don't like? And the audience perked up immediately. So my point is that for the most part, I don't really like doing that, but what one can do is find out where they're at and find the ways that the system is then oppressing them and use that as a wedge to start getting there. And also go back to the thing I said about it takes 10 years to change their mind. A lot of times what I'll do is I just plant seeds, you know. I plant seeds and I move on. And then who knows? It's like, you know, in 1992, I interviewed John Livingston, who wrote this great book called The Fallacy of Wildlife Conservation. Great book. And in there, he talks about, among other things, he talks about how evolution is based on cooperation, not competition. And when I first read that, when I interviewed him, I thought that was nuts. I thought that makes no sense to me. Everybody knows that evolution is based on competition. You know, that's what we're taught in school. That's what Richard Dawkins says. It's true. And I didn't argue with him because I was too polite. And also, I know that when you're doing an interview, as you know too, if you're doing an interview, you know, if you just say, "Hey, man, you're nuts," you know, the conversation's going to end. It's going to be a terrible interview. So I was like, yeah, he can say that. And here's the deal, is about 3 years later, with no discernible transformation or no discernible transition on my part, I could no longer conceptualize that evolution is based on competition, not cooperation. It didn't make any more sense to me. But it didn't come because I argued with John Livingston. It came because he planted a seed, and then I didn't even think about it, you know? It's like it just... He uses a phrase I love, ruminate, you know, like a cow, where you take it, you swallow it, you bring it back up, and you chew on it, and you put it back down, and you do that a few times. That's exactly what happened. It's like, huh, that's a pretty interesting idea. Evolution's based on cooperation. What a weird thing. And I didn't think about it. And then a few months later, it's like, bring it up, chew on it a little bit. Huh, that's really interesting. And maybe, and then a couple years later, boom, there we go. So for me, in that particular case, it didn't take 10 years. It took 3 years. So that's why I don't really argue so much as just give the information. They can do what they want with it because I can't control where they are. And I've also found that if I push too hard, I can push as hard as I want in my books because they can fight me, but they're not going to be yelling at me in the meantime. But if I do it in person, I mean, I'm sure you've noticed that if you run up against people's defense mechanisms, sometimes they get really mad at you. And they can throw out these arguments that may or may not make sense. But the point is not to doubt over their arguments. The point is to, you know, you put a little pinprick in their denial, and eventually that denial, I don't know how far I'm going to take the metaphor of the pinprick because I don't know what I can do with it, but eventually the balloon of denial loses its air, you know, whatever. So that's sort of how I deal with that. I mean, that's a question that you asked that I've thought about a lot. You know, honestly, you know, I'm not going to convince Barack Obama, and I'm not going to convince the head of Plum Creek Timber Company. So they're not my audience. It's like Howard Zinn had this great line about he doesn't really believe in speaking truth to power because they understand it anyway. They don't care. So what he believes in is speaking truth about power, and I love that.
In an online article titled Against Forgetting, you say, do not go numb in the face of this data. Do not turn away. I want you to feel the pain. Keep it like a coal inside your coat, a coal that burns and burns. I want all of us to do this because we should all want the pain of injustice to stop. We should want this pain to stop, not because we get used to it and it just doesn't bother us anymore, but because we stop the injustices and destruction that are causing the pain in the first place. I want us to feel how awful the destruction is and then act from this feeling. And I promise you two things. One, feeling this pain won't kill you. And two, not feeling this pain, continuing to go numb and avoid it will. How do we refuse to numb out and to allow the corporations and media to intentionally numb us out?
Well, I think it's through radio programs like this one. And I think it's through what we talked about earlier with having a supportive community, having friends that you can call up and cry with. And that really helps because we can't do this by ourselves. And we can't, like I said earlier, we can't fight this culture and our friends too. And so I think one of the ways we do it is by, you know, there are times where, you know, it's like, I can't do it. I can't do it anymore. And so I call up a friend of mine who is also doing this work, and they, you know, they carry me for a while, and then sometimes they are weak, and I can carry them for a while, and that's what a community is supposed to do, even if we don't agree on everything. So I think that's one of the ways that we keep from numbing is by having a community. Another way we can keep from numbing is just, you know, when we start to feel numb, then it's like, what's, you know, pay attention to it. It's, some of it is simply paying attention and being stubborn, you know. And also it really helps, for me at least, it really helps to have, and this is one of the reasons I do my work, is that it has really helped me to have analyses written by other people that will inoculate me against. Okay, like a great example would be Robert J. Lifton's Claims to Virtue, that when I read that, it's like, oh, I understand what the timber industry does now. I understand when they say that we need to go in and cut because of fire protection. These are the same people who 2 years ago were saying they need to cut because the wood's going to waste, and 2 years before that they said they needed to cut for this other reason. It's like when you see that there are scripts that are followed, then you can become in some ways inoculated to those scripts. So I also remember when I was, 25, 26, I was in the library in Spokane, Washington, and this book jumped off the shelf at me. It was by Neil Everdon. It was called The Natural Alien. And it was the first book I'd ever read that did not take a utilitarian worldview or an exploitative, a resource-based worldview as a given. And there was this great line in there about what do you do if after you present some impassioned defense of some creature, somebody says back to you, well, what good are they? And he says, really, the only thing you can do is to look back at them and say, well, what good are you? And not in terms of insulting them, but in terms of showing the absolute stupidity of that perspective. And the point is that I read this book, and I felt like this huge weight went off my shoulders because this was the first time I'd ever realized that it might not be that I'm crazy. It might be that the culture's crazy. And this was a tremendous release for me to have someone else saying this. And that's, once again, one of the reasons I try to do this is so that I can write that, you know, the GNP is the conversion of living to the dead. And it's like, oh, I don't have to worry about that thing so much anymore. And I remember reading about 1990, I was reading this book by Norman Solomon Martin Lee, I think, about how the media lies to us. And there was this was right about the time that Noriega went from being a U.S. ally to being, oh, this yeah. terrible person that they have to arrest. Just a couple weeks before on NPR, they'd been talking about this, the Panamanian president. And then I read in the book how any dictator that the United States likes is called a president, and any dictator that the United States doesn't like is called a strongman. I read that one afternoon. I get in the car. I'm going to drive. I was teaching Eastern time. I'm driving to school to work, and they say, Panamanian strongman, Manuel Noriega. And I had to pull the car over and just sit there. It's like, this is it. This is exactly what happens. And my point is that one of the ways that I was inoculated against these lies, inoculated against the numbness, is by reading the analysis, having somebody show me the pattern. Because once I can see the pattern, I'm much less likely to fall into it. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. I find that one of the ways I can monitor myself is that when I start getting, my feelings start getting intense enough, I find mm-hmm. myself wanting to either take a couple of aspirin or a antihistamine or maybe a glass of wine or whatever. As soon as I find myself wanting to do that, I'd say, okay, obviously, I've got stronger feelings here than I necessarily want to deal with, but, you know, really, let's not use these things to numb
right.
them out.
Right. Yeah,
that
makes sense.
Yeah. you know, once you identify what it is you turn to as a numbing device, then the minute you think of using that thing, it puts up like a red flag in you.
Which I think also comes down to a lot of just, and I don't mean this in a hoity-toity way at all, but a lot of just self-knowledge, which in some ways comes from experience. You know, it's like you saw that pattern because you had, you know, you did it for, you know, 10 years or whatever. I don't know. I mean, for myself, it'd be, I know that I make the same mistake. I have to make the same mistake like 300 times before I usually figure it out. And so, you know, there could be 300 times of numbing this thing, and it doesn't actually work to numb it. So it's like, well, okay, maybe the 301st time I'll try something else, and then that does work, and then I'll go back and do the original one another 100 times, and then, you know, eventually change. And there's a great line about this by R.D. Lang, too. I love this line about how do you plug a void plugging a void. And, you know, sometimes when we're feeling numb, we try to plug that void by using some other void that actually doesn't solve it, which once again can be perfectly fine, and it can actually be quite necessary in terms of recovery from some trauma or something. You know, if you have, you know, I have a friend who recently had a very, very terrible atrocity committed upon her, and, you know, she doesn't actually need to be doing activism right now. She doesn't actually need to be doing anything. If she wants to just watch television 24 hours a day, or if she wants to sleep 24 hours a day, if she wants to, you know, it'd be like if you were in a car wreck, you know. My point is that I completely agree with you that we need to watch out for when we numb, but there are also times when we need to completely rest because and recharge, you know. And we need to
sometimes.
Yeah, and I think we need to not be – I'm not suggesting you were saying this at all. I'm just thinking about myself. And there are some times where I get annoyed. See, it's a weird thing. You know, I'm one of the most prolific serious writers I know. You know, I've got 20-some books out. But I still – I sometimes get mad at myself because I spend some of the time during the day actually not writing. And then it's like, wait a second, this is ridiculous. What I'm doing is I'm sort of regathering for the next step. And sometimes you need to just rest and then move on. So, yeah, I sort of took that a different direction. Sorry.
That's quite all right. Having become deeply discouraged with pressuring the politicians to create change, Bill McKibben of 350.org is campaigning to hit the fossil fuel mega corporations in their pockets. He's running a campaign to get universities and other investors to divest from the stock of these corporations. And I remember, I'm old enough to remember that it worked back in South Africa a generation ago. Would it work now with the timber lords? Would a campaign to get people to divest, or are they already so rich that it'd be beside the point?
I don't think it would be beside the point. I think that, okay, I'm going to put a caveat here, which is that there are probably better historians of social change who could tell you the times that the conditions under which divestment is most likely to achieve success and times in which it's not. So I'm going to give more of a vague answer, which is that I think that as one part, I think that is certainly a legitimate tool as one of the tools in one's toolbox for attempting to dismantle the timber industry and or dismantle, you know, the fossil fuel industry, whatever it is you're targeting. I think it is certainly one valid tool in a toolbox. I think there are conditions in which obviously, a divestment campaign would not work against, and I was hoping by the time I got to this part of the sentence that I would know I would remember the corporation. It's one of the largest grain corporations on the planet.
Oh.
Really nasty. I'm sorry,
yeah.
What?
Yeah, I know.
Anyway, the point is that corporation is privately owned. So in that case, a divestment campaign would be completely useless. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So it's all specific to the industry. I don't think that it would be harmful, certainly. I think that divestment is a fine thing. One of the things it requires is a fairly large – it requires a mass movement to do it because you have to be able to put pressure on universities, et cetera, to the institutional holders to divest.
It requires people. You know, for every $1,000 they have, it requires us to have 100 people, you know.
Right.
Does laying our life and our liberty on the line by risking jail or beatings to lie down in front of a bulldozer or sit up in a tree or ring the White House. Are these better tools in our tool shed, toolbox?
I think that they're different tools in the tool shed. And here's part of the deal is that I don't in any way believe – you know, sometimes because of – especially some of my work, I get – labeled as the violence guy because I believe in some circumstances it is perfectly acceptable and necessary to fight back, by which I mean fight back. And but I when I get labeled the violence guy, I feel that's really unfair because what I really am is the everything guy, that I believe we need everything, and I believe that includes divestment programs. I believe that or can include divestment programs. I believe that can include blocking yourself to trees. But those are all different tools to be used when the circumstances require or when it's most effective, and to be not used when it's not effective. And I first learned this when I was teaching at Pelican Bay State Prison, which is a super maximum security prison here in Northern California. And I was fully aware every time that I walked in that I was participating on the biggest racist gulag on the planet. But at the same time, a lot of my students were saying that the only things that were keeping them sane were our classes. So that's the moment that the reform versus revolution dichotomy fell apart for me. So I really think that, you know, it's like there are a lot of blockades, and I'm not sure what the point is, because when I was doing the work back in Eastern Washington, there would be blockades, but a lot of times the blockade would be set up so that you could file an injunction. Basically, you're trying to hold them off for a day so you can get an injunction to then legally stop them longer, stop them through the judicial system. And my point on that is that, like, when there have been tar sands blockades, they stop the construction of a road or something, usually for a day. And that's, I'd rather they stop it for a day than not. But on a larger scale, it really helps, I think, to think strategically. I'm thinking about the blockades that happened in France during the general strike a couple years ago, where they blockaded oil terminals and were pretty much able to shut down the French economy. And so I don't think you can separate the utility of a tactic from its part in a larger strategy. And if your tactic consists simply of throwing a rock through a window, it's like, okay, and? You know, on the other hand, throwing a rock through a window could be an effective thing if it ties into your larger strategy and you understand how it ties into your larger strategy. And so it's the same thing with sitting in front of a bulldozer or filing a lawsuit. Any of those things, I think that's part of the problem, is that I don't know necessarily that a lot of us have thought about what our goals are, what our proximate and ultimate goals are, and also the steps A, B, C to get there. And I think that we need to think about this in terms of, we need to think like a serious resistance movement, and we need to think like a military. You know, the military will set up, okay, these are our goals. We want to accomplish A, B, and C. Okay, so accomplish A, B, and C. First, we have to do subsets 1, 2, and 3. And I think we need to think more strategically that way. And this is not just militarily, but the right wing has done a fabulous and disgusting job of this over the past 40 years, that they have systematically set out, for example, to get themselves elected to every electable position possible. And so that's how you get these crazy things like in Texas where the school boards can the latest thing I heard is that they're no longer calling it the slave trade, but they're calling it the triangle trade. And one of the ways they can do this is because for the last 40 years, they have been really effectively packing these boards. And it's happened here. It's crazy. The Tea Party in this county, they make no bones about this. They're systematically getting themselves put onto every board. They control a lot of the Harbor Commission. They've been able to get rid of the solid waste disposal. They're in the process of doing that. And it doesn't even matter why. And they have taken over the school board. This is, And my point is not, oh, only work within the system to get on those boards. My point is not that at all. My point is that this has been part of a long-term 40 to 50-year strategy. And I don't think we have 40 to 50 years left, but that doesn't alter the fact that I think we need to think strategically and say, how is this blockade going to help us? How is this radio program? What's the point? You know, what is the point of me writing these books? What is the point of you doing this radio program? And I'm not – right now these are both rhetorical questions because I think you know the answer to yours and I know the answer to mine. But the point is that when people do this work, they should be asking themselves, how does my work fit into the larger struggle? And what am I actually trying to accomplish? And how will me doing this thing add to that struggle? And I'm not asking for 24-year-olds or 18-year-olds to be able to answer these questions because, like I said, when I first started doing the activism, it's like I didn't even know why I'm holding a sign, and I didn't know how it fit in. But I think that's fine for a 15 or 20 or 25-year-old to maybe not understand these things. But by the time we get to be in our 40s and 50s, or, you know, I'm 52, and by this time I should, I mean, if I've been doing this for 20 or 30 years, I should have an idea of how this fits into a larger struggle.
It's taken me, I'll turn 70 next year, and it's taken me virtually the whole of my life. So believe me, at 50, if I had known at 52 what you seem to know now and what I know now, you've got a good future ahead of you. We're running virtually out of time, and I really, really want you to be able, as an ending note, to read the ending note of your book, page 142,
okay.
What is your relationship to the future? Because I think our listeners need to be asking themselves this.
Okay, so you want me to read from there to the middle of 143?
Yes.
Okay. What is your relationship with the future? There is nothing humans can do to maintain industrial wood and paper production and maintain forests, too. The crisis will resolve itself when civilized humans walk away from doing what they've been doing. Those in power won't stop deliberately. Never forget Red Cloud's warning. They made as many promises, more than I can remember. But they never kept but one. They promised to take our land, and they took it. What, then, can you do if you're of good heart? You can fight to keep this particular tree standing, this particular forest functioning. You can help open your friends and coworkers' eyes to the wonder and intrinsic value and legitimate standing of forests and forest dwellers. We don't need to stop the forest crisis. Nature will stop it. As the global economy becomes more chaotic and the societies addicted to it become more impoverished, the best we can do is to keep some doors open, prevent those in power from causing those we love to go extinct, defend what is important, undermine what is superfluous, and destroy what is destructive. We can consume less. We can eat locally grown foods. We can make our own food, clothing, and shelter so as to not deny others the right and ability to provide for themselves. Those of us in the heart of empire can work to undermine the social and political basis for our inordinate power over others. We can work to implement radical equality. We can spend time in forests. We can ask the trees and forests what they want. Early on, this book described a walk through an old-growth forest, and it ends on the same note by inviting you to do the same. We humans came from forests, and to them we will return. We've been the obedient servants of Gilgamesh for 5,000 years. We've cut a path of destruction, ignored the spreading deserts, disregarded the disappearing animals, the foul barren water, the moving planet. We've destroyed most of the Earth's natural forest cover, and we can pretend we can live without it. The story we've been handed says that Gilgamesh defeated the forest protectors and the forces of civilization won the battle for the forest, but it's not true. The epic isn't over, and Enlil's curse will not be lifted until we reject the easy and false promises of Gilgamesh and return with respect and humility to the forest. And then I would say, in addition, fight like hell to protect them.
Well, thank you so much for that and for this conversation. We only asked you about a quarter of the questions we meant to, but that's all right because I think it's been a very deep conversation.
Oh, it's been great, and let's do it again sometime.
Yes. For touching our hearts and opening our eyes, and thank you to our listeners. Please contact Derek Jensen to learn more, to offer service, or to obtain his book. Next week's guest will be Sabine Lichtenfeld, representing Tamara Peace Research Center in southern Portugal, an international training and experimental site for the development of peace research Under the motto, Think Locally, Act Globally, approximately 200 people live, work, and study in Tamara. Please join us again next week to support Tamara's important vision.
Spring savings are in full bloom right now at Lowe's, where you'll find great deals on everything you need to get your home in shape for the season. So hurry into your neighborhood store today to save big on all of your spring home improvement needs, like a $100 Lowe's gift card with a purchase of in-stock Husqvarna riding lawnmowers. Make your home happy all season long with great brands and great prices right now at Lowe's. Offer valid 3/9 through 3/21. Excludes garden tractors and zero-turn radius mowers. Excludes repaired and reconditioned items. Selection varies by location. U.S. only.